The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Really thank everybody for joining us today, whenever you happen to be listening to this. This will be releasing, I believe, on March 26th, 2022. A lot of you listen right as soon as it comes out. We appreciate that. But if you get this later, we appreciate that too. So I've got Jim in the remote studio. He's got a slew of questions for us today that we're going to try to get through. I know he's got a meeting to get to in about an hour or so, so we're going to dive right into the questions. As he's getting his pile ready, I'll share everybody a reminder of how to send questions into the show. Best way to do it probably is email Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And just make sure in the pod or in the subject line you make it clear this is a question for the podcast. That'll make it easy for him to file into his sophisticated filing system. And then you can also go to the website and learn a little bit more about us, as well as fill in a contact form on there where you can submit questions. That website, of course, is jimhelps.com, Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. So we'll fire up Jim's microphone and see if he's ready with his pile of questions.
I am.
Perfect.
Excellent. We're going to start with the Social Security question, as always, folks. And then we're going to go to the new question of the week. And then we will go to old questions. We're trying to plow through November. The majority of the questions I have now are from November. There's a couple of holdouts from October, but most of them are from November. So if you submitted a question in November of last year, you might be hearing it in the not too distant future on the show. Okay. Are you ready for your first, actually only Social Security question, unless I change my mind? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You know me. I'm subject to change.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
I am totally ready and excited.
I'm sure you are. Where is this guy from? Gives his name. Gives me an awful lot of information about him, but he doesn't tell me where he's from. We're going to call him George.
From podcast
George from land. George from a road to nowhere. Okay. It says, hi, Chris. At least he knows how to begin it. Mm. And then he puts in parentheses, Jim and Bob, too. He knows we're not quite the go-to people for Social Security. I'm a longtime listener and enjoy the banter, but sometimes you need to let Jim get a word in edgewise. Well, thank
true.
You, listener.
Yeah,
I agree.
Jim gets hardly any words out anymore.
It is. If I would have known he began with this, I'd have jumped this to the top of the pile a long time ago. The man is definitely wise. We know that. Okay. With the current inflation rate, I was wondering about the PIA at my full retirement age. And PIA, folks, is primary insurance amount. I'm sure Chris will talk about it when he answers this question. I was wondering about the PIA at my full retirement age and if it will grow with inflation. during the time I intend to delay 67, my full retirement age, until 70. I know I will be increasing by 8% a year, non-compounded, over those 3 years, to end up with 24% more Social Security benefit than just my PIA. But will my PIA increase with compound inflation over those 3 years? Now, there's a lot more he asked in here, but I don't think it's necessary to get into. If I feel it is, I'll spout it out. But he just starts to give some math examples. I don't necessarily think you need those. Do you want them?
No. No, I think it's actually a straightforward but an excellent question, because it's an area about Social Security, and like many areas of Social Security, that at face value seems pretty straightforward, but then gets confusing when you start to think about it a little more deeply and try to really understand how it works. And so if you understand the inner workings of Social Security, which I do my best to do, I still discover new things occasionally, not as frequently anymore, because I've been digging into Social Security issues for many, many years now. And I'm one of those guys that's pretty, curious, I guess you might say. So when some simple question comes up, if I can't find a clear answer, I keep digging and digging and digging. Usually while I'm digging, I find all kinds of other interesting information that I wasn't even looking for. But anyway, digging into Social Security, I've got the following understanding, which most people, it isn't apparent how this all works. And that is that the PIA, your primary insurance amount, is a separate number from your benefit that you actually get paid. The only time that your PIA and your benefit amount are the same is if you are simply claiming at what we call your full retirement age, not claiming early, not claiming late. It is essentially what it is, with the benefit itself being adjusted by several things, claiming early, claiming late, and any accumulated cost of living adjustments that have happened since you turned age 62, which, unlike this person whose full retirement age is 67, there's actually cumulative cost of living adjustments. So let me explain a little more plainly. Your primary insurance amount is that retirement estimate that is, or the benefit amount for your full retirement age. And they figure that out. When I say they, Social Security determines your official PIA when you turn 62 years old. Even though you cannot collect your PIA at that time, they set it at that point. That's the point when they take a snapshot of your earnings record. They apply all of the indexing to those past earnings based on the wage inflation rates that have happened in the past. All of this we've talked about on the show before, and you can Google this and look this kind of stuff up. And they calculate ultimately your PIA. Let's say it comes up to $1,500. That's going to be your full retirement age benefit without any type of inflation adjustments or any other adjustments for early or late claiming. That is actually established, though, when you're 62. Because why 62? Because that is your first age of eligibility, they call it. That's as the earliest that you can claim your own retirement benefit under standard conditions. So they have to do the calculation to be prepared for you to walk in the door to claim. Now, we all know if you claim early at 62, it's your benefit's going to be reduced. You take your PIA of 1500 and reduce it actually by 30% if you had a full retirement age of 67, but you were in there claiming at 62. But what if you delay? And he mentioned not just waiting until full retirement age, but actually delaying past there. And he is correct that every year you delay, although they give you credits monthly, but we talk about it in yearly terms, every year that you delay past your full retirement age, your benefit increases. This is where the confusion comes from. These increases or decreases, that 30% reduction that I talked about, the 8% increases as you delay past your full retirement age, those increases or decreases aren't actually changing your PIA. Your PIA is what it is. In my example, it's $1,500. Nothing changes that unless you have earnings recorded after the age of 62 that might drive that upwards. So they do, as I've mentioned before on the show, every year if you've got earnings, they're going to factor it into your earnings record and see if it increases your PIA. And if it does, they'll grant you those adjustments to your PIA. But let's assuming that doesn't happen. Once that 1500 is established, that's your PIA forever and ever. Amen. Only thing that can adjust it typically is WEP, which we're not going to get into today. So what's actually being adjusted with the early claiming, that 30% reduction or the 8% increases? That's the benefit. What they actually give to you is calculated based on your PIA and then other factors. Those other factors being, are you claiming earlier than your full retirement age or are you claiming later? Have you missed out on any cost of living adjustments that have been granted to people since the day you became first eligible, which is when you were 62? So when you actually collect your benefit, say that $1,500, let's just wander through the timeline here. He's turned 62. They establish his PIA as $1,500, but he waits until 67. When he goes in to claim, he doesn't just get the $1,500. They'll say, well, your PIA is $1,500, but let's take a look and see what cost of living adjustments have we credited people with since you were 62? And they apply those to the benefit they actually are going to pay you. So you'll be paid more than the $1,500. If you wait until after 67 in his case, and you're taking advantage of those 8% increases, let's say you wait until 70. They're going to not increase your PIA itself. They're going to say, well, your PIA was $1,500, but your benefit first is going to receive 8% simple growth, so 24% total. That $1,500 is going to become $1,860 because of delayed retirement credits. But hang on a minute. Let's take a look at all the cost of living adjustments that have been applied since you became first eligible, and we're going to grant those to you as well. So he has an excellent question, because in a high inflation rate environment like this, you might be thinking, my gosh, I'm delaying, I'm going to get 8, but if I don't get the cost of living adjustments, which this year might be like 6 or 7%, we won't know until October when they release it, but inflation, as everybody knows, recently has been very, very high compared to what it's been for the past 10, 15 years. We're about to see a cost of living adjustment. We just saw a big one, 5.9%. But we might see even bigger ones this coming up. If I'm going to not get those, maybe that 8% increase is not that big a deal. Don't worry, you get both, is the bottom line. So they don't, on one hand, no, it doesn't affect the PIA itself because of the reasons I mentioned. Your PIA is a locked-in amount that they use as the basis of your benefit. But when they do the benefit calculation, they're going to give you the benefit of those cost of living adjustments in addition to delayed retirement credits that you may have earned by waiting until after your full retirement age. So he's got nothing to worry about here. If his intent, if his analysis determined that it made sense for him to wait until 70 and collect the 24% higher benefit for the rest of his life, and for his spouse, if he leaves his benefit behind and his benefit was bigger than his spouse's benefit, still delaying to 70 makes perfect sense, even in a high inflation rate environment, because you're still going to get those cost of living adjustments as well as the delayed retirement credits. So I think that wraps what I needed to share on that topic. Did it all make sense to you, Jim? James? I surprised him. He was off getting a snack in the kitchen or something, is my guess, because of the remote studio. He has sleeping quarters there. He has a basement. He has an entertainment area. He's got a nice deck outside.
I'm back.
Oh, hi.
Sorry about that. The phone kept ringing, the office phone. No one was answering it. And you get mad when my phone rings here at the house.
Mm-hmm. I had you muted so we couldn't hear it. So
I put my personal home phone in the closet because I don't know how to shut it off. But... but the office phone was ringing when you were yammering on and on and on, and I kept thinking, God, do I have enough time to run into the kitchen and mute the phone?
Well, you almost did. So it's okay.
So that's what I went and did.
Okay. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
I answered the question.
I know you did. You're going on and on and on like that guy
said.
Well,
I wanted to be thorough. But now it's all you.
Well, everybody can wake up now. Just teasing. Okay. We got a couple of good questions of the week and some pretty involved ones. And a couple that I want to run by the Ed Slot Group and another one by Darcy, the attorney who's going to become the new Pete. So I don't want to attempt to answer those, even though I thought they were good questions, until I get some better clarity. But this question is pretty good because we could go on with it a little. We could theoretically do an entire EDU show on this topic, but we're certainly not going to. It's a simple question that could have a very evolved or involved answer. We'll try to keep it brief. It's more up your realm because it has to do with the actual process we do and how we account for a certain something and if that certain something could be used for a certain other thing. So let me tell you, I'll read the question. Gives his name, does not give where he's from. Okay. It says, Jim, I have been listening to your podcast. He totally blew you off, by the way, on that the email.
Okay. Well, I'll stay quiet.
I'll put you in because you're going to end up answering a lot of this. Jim and Chris.
So I should pay attention.
So pay attention.
Okay.
I've been listening to your podcast for many, many years and have heard details about your retirement planning process. But I don't think I've ever heard you discuss this before. And I'll pause before getting to it. We have talked about this before and in the realm of what he is meaning. He just might have missed those podcasts, or it may have been a while ago since we did it. Assuming one has significant amount of home equity, how will that fit into your planning process? For example, do you think it can support funding long-term care in some way? Very simple question. Mm-hmm. We could do a whole show on this.
True.
So let me just share, and then Chris, as everybody knows, my position at the firm is evolving, where I meet less and less with actual clients unless you're on the investment and insurance side. The retirement planning Chris does, so I'm going to let him explain how he does a lot. But we also plan as a team at our firm. We always do. Chris, Bob, and myself will always plan every client case together. On certain days of the week. Junior, affectionately known as Andrew and Jacob, they will also be there, as well as Greg, who does long-term care in our office. And when it comes to the topic of long-term care, we definitely do look at home equity. Now, it's not going to work for everyone because some people are adamant they want to pass the home on to children and they don't want to debit home equity. Other people are less inclined to want to debit home equity. They don't mind. But the ability to get at the equity, listeners, comes with a cost. That's what I want to say. Mm-hmm. Then Chris can explain how he factors it in. But home equity is not free. You can't just rip off some roof shingles and go to the grocery store and buy that week's groceries. You can't take out a closet door and trade it in for a new car. Well, closet door isn't going to get a new car nowadays. But you get my point, folks. Home equity is illiquid. It's locked into the value of your home. So you have to pay to access it. You're going to pay either through a traditional HELOC, home equity line of credit, assuming you can qualify in retirement. But if you could, you could borrow money that way, but then you immediately create a liability on the other side of the ledger, if you will, because you have to start paying the HELOC back right away. So to battle that, the industry and the federal government through the Housing and Urban Development have created and then support, HUD supports, reverse mortgages. So you could access equity in your home through a reverse mortgage. But there's some caveats with that. You only get about half the equity, not all of it, and you still have to pay for it. It's not free. So why am I sharing that? If you're sitting in a $600,000 home, don't say, wow, I have $600,000. You don't, unless you're going to leave the home. And there is where home equity can also really shine, especially later in life for long-term care needs and aging assistance, which is what this gentleman is talking about. When we do planning, the most difficult challenge or strategies that we have to come up with for many of our clients, not all of them, is planning where one spouse, called the community spouse, is still healthy and wants to stay in the home, but the other spouse is needing some type of aging assistance, whether it's in-home care, whether it is going to be institutionalized care, whether it's memory care. This type of planning is the most difficult because many people, they have structured their minimum dignity floor to maintain the household, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. So all that income is going, the secure income is going to take care of those blocks of expenses. But now you have this massive block of additional spending to cover, if you will, and often it's $50,000 to $80,000 a year for some type of in-home care or assisted living facility, even adult daycare style care that now has to be covered. And we can use, through a reverse mortgage or other strategies, home equity. But when there's a widow or a widower, it's actually a lot easier to satisfy aging. And we often do rely at that point, Chris, on home equity. Why don't you explain a little bit? Let's not go too deep. I want to keep this more of a Q&A than an EDU. Kind of that pass off that I gave you. I set the stage for how when we do planning, we look at aging assistance from two standpoints, the couple and the widow or the widower, and oftentimes how things are better in the widow-widower stage. And that's where home equity shines, folks, especially for assisted living, because if you're going to leave the home at that point, you can get 100% of the equity.
Well, I guess let me back up to the first part of his question, which is, you know, how do we factor in home equity into the planning? Because of the strings that are attached to accessing home equity, what we would call in the business the illiquidity or lack of liquidity of that equity. You can't just suddenly have access to it to spend on something else. We do kind of generally leave that as one of the last resources to consider just because of those strings or costs that are attached to accessing it. It is not like your other assets. It has its own very special characteristics. So we certainly don't include that as just part of your pooled assets from which you're going to spend in retirement. Where it can make the most sense is like this listener who wrote the email implied, which is, you know, down the road, the just-in-case stuff that aren't like your regular food spending and things we know are going to happen throughout retirement, maybe point to that reserve or asset that is home equity and say, you know, even though it's kind of hard to get if we had to down the road for maybe something like long-term care or aging, could we tap that? And Jim is exactly right that if you're still wanting to live in the home, that restricts how much access you have to it. Generally, he is right. The rule of thumb is half of it might be available in a reverse mortgage kind of a situation. Those are, I will say, with people in their 60s and 70s and 80s who might be accessing it for these purposes, that is a more popular approach than a traditional mortgage, which requires payments on it in a traditional sense. There's the qualification issue that can be a problem since you no longer have the type of income you had when you were working. And then there's the cash flow issue that you've got these big payments that are now due once you extract it. So that's where the reverse mortgage really kind of shines for a lot of people in this case. And then there's the, well, how do I access more of it? well, you have to sell it. And people might be saying, well, Jim and Chris, you're missing one. Why don't I'm just going to plan to downsize. I don't, you know, I'd like to still live here, but I'm going to downsize. And so I don't need to worry about a reverse mortgage. I'm going to sell it and I can get half of it because I'll go to a half size house. That sounds in our, you know, it turns out that that's a very romanticized idea. What we find in practice is that people, once they start looking at the type of house that they would be moving into, well, first of all, consider the age this is happening. And this is for long term down there. You're thinking about upheaval of your whole life and moving when you're in your 70s or maybe 80s. I don't know the last time you moved, but for me, even when I was in my 20s or 30s, it was quite an undertaking and very chaotic. Imagine doing that now when you're 70 or 80 years old. Not real attractive. And then if you could even find a place, is it maybe it's smaller, but smaller usually also means a completely different neighborhood, a completely different part of town, completely different amenities, completely different location compared to your friends. You know, everything factors into this. So if you've got this idea in your head, you're just going to downsize, that I would question as far as a good, reliable long-term plan. That's kind of dicey. So we kind of then are back into this situation where we've got the reverse mortgage idea, maybe access half. And then ultimately, for, you know, longevity for the second spouse who lasts the longest, right? It's almost never the case where both people pass at the same time, or a single person, right? A single person actually has an advantage with this type of planning because they don't have to worry about keeping another spouse in the home while they have left to go to memory care, assisted living, nursing home care, you know, whatever it may be. If you're single or you're the single remaining spouse after your spouse has passed away, the not just the house and its proceeds, but all the expenses, all the cash flows that were directed to support that house now are available to go with you to that facility that you might be trying to fund. So there's all these moving parts in here. I think it is true that with our style of planning, where home equity comes into play for the most part is it is this long-term care and aging assistance kind of a scenario. And we look at you know, the situation with both of you alive, with only one of you alive, etc., and try to put together something that makes sense. If we're having to reserve or resort to using the home equity, if there's a way to put together a good plan without it, honestly, we usually just leave it off to the side and say, you know, the house is just going to become part of your estate. That'll go to your heirs. They can keep it, sell it, whatever they want to do with it. But because it's so hard to extract the cash from it to use it, we're just going to leave it alone because we don't need it for anything. That's typically how we approach it. But, you know, every case is different. But certainly it can be a factor, particularly with the aging and long-term care.
I am here this time. Okay. I just couldn't unpause the unmute the mic. So, hey, what are you doing? I'm on a TV tray, sitting on a wood chair in a room that still has all the stuff that was in my basement when the pipes burst last year. I still haven't fixed it yet. My friend who's going to do the work for me, he really, really messed up his, I felt so bad for the guy. He was out riding his motorcycle and he's a big dude. If you met him, looks like a football player, but he's in his early 50s now and the bike was ready to fall and he went and grabbed it and he has no idea how, but he messed up a bunch of tendons in his ankle. I have no idea how. And he had to have this type of surgery and he had to stay off it for months and months and then gradually get back in. It just he couldn't believe doing something stupid. I did tell him jokingly, you know, welcome to turning 50. But so because of all that, he didn't have a chance to do it. So this room is still, it's a good thing I'm single. The room is just still just cluttered with everything from the basement. And Rachel is very accommodative. She stays out of this room because he can't really walk in it. So anyways, that's kind of why it takes me a long time to maneuver inside this room and get to things. Okay, I think you covered that all right. And I think one few things that I want to mention, though, about home equity. This is just Chris and I's opinion. This is how we look at it. I know Professor Pfau, Wade Pfau, he looks at home equity different. He encourages to use it as what he calls a buffer asset and gets into things like that. We don't generally practice that train of thought here at our firm, which is not to say it's right or wrong. So home equity is a unique asset. It truly is. It's often the biggest asset or one of the biggest pools of assets that retirees have. It's just very illiquid and it's very emotional. It's your home. People don't generally want to leave their home. It's easy for us to say in our mid to late 50s, as Chris and I are recording, how, oh, you can go into assisted living. You might need to then move out of the home and sell it at that time. It's very easy for us to say it now because we're not faced with that. But when we are going to someday have to confront that very real reality, I'm not going to want to leave my home. And emotionally, I just know it's going to be difficult. So home equity comes with that emotional element too, Chris. It's almost like when we work with people who inherit assets, especially from someone that they loved dearly. Those assets often have an emotional element to them as well. So I just want to share with people, I don't necessarily think there's a right or wrong answer for using home equity. We often do earmark it for aging assistance care. Equity in real estate is playing a major role in my long-term care plan, as I've shared on previous shows.
But not equity in your personal residence so much.
No, equity in another, mm-hmm. Right, correct.
Yeah, and I didn't mention that. I kind of meant to as I was thinking about everything we were discussing. If you've got a second home, that's a whole other story. That one you don't need to keep if one of you goes into care. You can plan to sell it. Now you do have to realize it could take some time to sell it. So there's that still that a little bit of liquidity issue there. But that's different than trying to sell the home out from under yourself where someone needs to live there. Second property, that's a whole different kind of deal.
Exactly. And that's what Chris is referencing with me as I shared on the podcast. Because of my stroke and AFib, it's going to be next to impossible for me to get insurance for pretty much forever. Mm-hmm. And I've allocated my office building in Fort Collins as now my long-term care plan. That's what it is. But we can hold that discussion for another day. But that equity building in that home is now to fund it's pretty much my long-term care policy, Chris. I just have one made out of wood and bricks, whereas most people have it made out of a contract with an insurance company. Okay. Moving on to other questions now. This one, we're in November now. This is a brief one, very easy to get to. Do not know where he is, gives his name, but again, we are going to call him George. Says, I am 63 with no earned income and not collecting Social Security. I am living off of my savings and some required minimum distribution from my IRA. I want to point out to him it's not a required minimum distribution at 63, so he's probably just taking a regular distribution, Chris, not necessarily a RMD.
Unless he has an inherited IRA.
True. Good point. He asks, can I still do Roth conversions to bring me to the top of my bracket? Yes. Even though you're not working, you can do conversions. Contributions to a Roth IRA require you to be working and have a salary or earnings. To convert, you just need an IRA. And you can convert that you can have no income like this gentleman, short of what he's already told us, savings and some type of distribution from an IRA. Or you can be Bill Gates with millions of probably annual income. And you can still do a conversion. Mm-hmm. So can he do the conversion and fill up all those low brackets that he probably rightly realizes are being wasted because he's not filling them? Absolutely. Does it make sense to do it? That's something else entirely. My gut tells me yes, because even the lower bracket, which is now 12, is going to go to 15. So even though he doesn't have much income, Chris, I think paying taxes today at 12 instead of in the future at 15 makes sense. Or he doesn't get into it. But if he's going to leave the IRA to a beneficiary, a child, say, especially if that beneficiary is in a much higher bracket, it would definitely help that beneficiary. So in his tax planning number, 210, he doesn't mention if there's a 2. So he might just be 1 and 0. he has to decide, should he optimize his or his child's? And it may very well make sense to fill that lower bracket. So, yes, you can do it. We're not entirely certain you should. That would require a lot more information than we have. Anything else you want to add?
Just one little thing related to my previous comment. If he has RMDs because he has an inherited IRA, you cannot convert from an inherited IRA. So if that's his only IRA, although if they're tiny, must not be very large and probably isn't his only one. If he's trying to, you know, delay and live off of that, he's probably got others, I'm assuming. But just in case, and people are thinking, since we brought up the idea of an inherited IRA, keep in mind, you cannot convert that. So wanted to point that out too.
I agree. Okay, next question. All right, this gentleman is from Colorado. I've actually spoken with him before. So I know his name, and he gives his name, but he signed his name. It must be a nickname. And I don't want to give it away because we do protect people's privacy. I'm not going to read this gentleman's name on the podcast. I have to say, because I know he's listening, he's got a fighter pilot name. This dude could be a fighter pilot. It just, the name just oozes fighter pilot.
His nickname or his real name?
His real name, his first name, no, it doesn't ooze fighter pilot at all. His last name does. But when he combines it with, I guess, his nickname.
For his first name? Yeah. Okay.
He's nailed it. This guy should, if he's not, I don't know what he does for a living.
Well, maybe he was.
If you're not, maybe he was a fighter pilot. He should. Yeah. If not a fighter pilot, a NASCAR driver or something. He's got that kind of name. It's just, it's really, if he gives me permission to say his name, because I most likely will be talking to him again at some point this year, or he knows who he is when he hears the question. If he gives me permission to use his fighter pilot name, I'll share it, and then everybody can decide for themselves, yeah, that's a fighter pilot name.
Okay.
All right, just had to throw that out there. Okay. So this is actually came the last day of October, so technically right before November pile. He says, first, I love the show. Think how much we would love a third show. I don't know what he means by think how much we would love a third show. You should just say we would love a third show. So there's someone else for a third show, by the way, Chris. Okay, he says, in 2, maybe 3 years, I will need more secure income to cover our minimum dignity expenses based on my projections. He is a DIYer, Chris, for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. I plan to use a single premium immediate annuity with money from my wife's IRA. Due to illiquid investments that we own, here you go, right from the home equity into this, illiquid investments, you can't get at them when you might need them. He says, due to illiquid investments, we will not have cash available to buy the SPIA. When I say SPIA, folks, it means single premium immediate annuity, SPIA, for an additional 2 to 3 years. If we want to use IRA money, will we be forced to having to use a QLAC? QLAC, folks, Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract. Chris did a series of shows. He loves this series we did several years ago. A 5-part series on QLACs. He talks about them all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You do. QLACs are a special type of deferred annuity that can be held inside an IRA, which will postpone required minimum distributions on that annuity only until you're age 85. So he's asking, does he have to use a QLAC, Chris, because he wants to buy an annuity with IRA money to provide the income he needs for his minimum dignity floor? So he continues, or can we just purchase a SPIA inside the IRA? If we use a QLAC, there would only be a limited delay because I want to turn it on right away. Says, in either case, QLAC or SPIA, would the monthly payments stay inside the IRA until I actually remove them? Or are they going to be paid to me as taxable income. So a couple of things going on here, folks. First, yes, you can buy a single premium immediate annuity inside an IRA because it's going to start paying its money out right away.
Yep.
You can buy a deferred annuity that's not a QLAC. Mm-hmm. You can buy a deferred annuity inside an IRA as long as you turn on the income from that deferred annuity by age 72, the age you have to be now to start taking required minimum distributions. A QLAC is a deferred annuity that allows you to wait until 85. You can turn it on earlier, but the latest you can go is 85. The benefit of a QLAC is the longer you wait, the more you get, as he pointed out. So yes, you can buy a SPIA. You can buy a SPIA at age 85. You can buy a SPIA at age 50 inside an IRA. But it's going to start paying out right away. No matter what your age is, it starts paying out within 13 months. Most will pay out, when I say right away, it's the following month from when you opened them. By law, a SPIA must pay out within 13 months of purchase. So the ability to buy it is there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, folks, just pay out into the IRA and sit there until you take it out. The annuity, the SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, essentially becomes an IRA of its own.
Right.
You're going to take money out of a brokerage account, or not a brokerage account, your IRA. You're going to transfer it to an insurance company. They'll put it in an annuity, a SPIA, but the SPIA is structured as an IRA. So it's its own IRA. And it will pay out, as I said, within 13 months. Most likely you're going to turn it on right away, so they'll start paying you the very next month. And the income comes out monthly, quarterly, or annually, you choose. But it comes directly to you, and mm-hmm. it's taxable to you.
Yep. So in his case, it's pretty straightforward. He doesn't need to be concerned about the QLAC or anything because he wants it to start right away. And as you mentioned, totally allowable to have a SPIA in an IRA wrapper at the insurance company of your choice.
And he ends with a simple question, and it can lead into one more thing I want to point out. He says, what would lowering the total value of my IRA to buy the SPIA due to our required minimum distributions? Mm-hmm. Very good question.
That is a good question.
So here's what happens, folks. Let's just say this gentleman had $500,000 inside. No, we'll make it $1 million because I like a round number. He has $1 million inside his IRA, and it's going to take $500,000 into a SPIA. So he still has, Chris, when he finishes that transaction, he still has $1 million. Well, he doesn't really have $1 million anymore in an IRA. He has a $500,000 IRA because it's no longer worth $1 million. And he has a SPIA that cost him $500,000. Mm-hmm. The trade-off with a single premium immediate annuity, folks, there's no getting that money back. There are a couple of SPIAs nationwide is big in this where they allow you to get some money out at stated periods of time from a SPIA. Your income will drop a respective amount. So when I say that SPIAs are totally illiquid, technically they're not. There's a couple of insurance companies that give them a little bit of liquidity. But for the most part, when you buy a SPIA, the money is gone. You cannot get it. Now here he says, what's this going to do to my RMD? Well, the RMD, Chris, on his remaining $500,000 IRA goes by the same rules. Your first year's RMD, folks, at 63 is going to be about 3.7%. So that $500,000 is going to be subject to about 3.7, Chris, and I don't know if you have a calculator. I don't. What would that RMD be?
For the $500,000?
Yeah.
It's going to be half of $37,000, so $18,500.
Okay. Now he has a SPIA, folks, that he put $500,000 in. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're going to get a payout in your early 60s of about 6, 7% from a SPIA. Let's say 6.5. I don't know. Let's just make that up. Mm-hmm. He's got how much coming out of that $500,000 IRA SPIA, Chris, if it was a 6.5% payout?
6.5 of half a million. I thought you liked round numbers, by the way. 32,500.
Okay. As Chris already pointed out, and these are approximate numbers, folks. Mm-hmm. Follow the logic, not the math. We're doing this. I don't have any calculator or charts in front of me. But what I'm trying to say, the RMD on half a million dollars is going to be about $18,500. So if the SPIA is paying out $32,000, and everybody knows that excess RMD from an IRA can be used to offset RMDs on other IRAs, you might be chomping at the bits thinking this is brilliant. The $32,000 is going to cover nearly the full RMD, which is $18,500 each, or $37,000 for the million, and he's taking out $32,000. He only needs to take out another $5,000. Doesn't work that way, does it, Chris?
No, and it'd be nice if it did, but it doesn't, because once you have annuitized the IRA, the good news is they count that, whatever the annuity payment is, they consider that to be the RMD from that $500,000, we'll call it, account. It's now a product at an insurance company, but it only satisfies the RMD from that account. Takes the math out of it. That way you don't have to worry about calculating an RMD for that account. The distribution, the payment, is the RMD by definition. The other $500,000 is treated as its own standalone. All your other IRAs now can consolidate, or that's not the right word, when you combine into one RMD for all of your combined IRAs, we don't call it consolidated. It's what's the word, Jim? I'm having a gym moment here.
You're having a gym moment, and you threw me for a loop. I know there is a certain word for it, and I can't think of it either. So consolidated and combined is fine, but it's not the word we're looking
for. So all your non-annuitized IRAs now are considered one big IRA, and they don't care where you pull the RMD for the combined RMD from your other non-annuitized IRAs. This one has its own rule, its own RMD. The payment itself is the RMD, only to satisfy that one account.
Exactly. So it would lower, he wants to know what would happen in our example, it would lower the RMD of your traditional liquid non-annuitized IRA only because there's no not a millionaire anymore, there's only half a million. But on your other IRA, it's going to be paying out much, much more.
Yeah. So combined, in here, in your example you were using, combined, there's going to be $51,000 coming out. Mm-hmm. Where if you were just taking the RMD from the million, it would only be $37,000.
But folks, before you start saying, "Oh, that's crazy," the gentleman wants more secure income.
Right.
He needs the income to cover his minimum dignity floor. Right. So that's the whole point. And you want to get as much income as you can. One of the purest and simplest forms of lifetime guaranteed income, if you don't have any more Social Security or pension, is a single premium immediate annuity. And it should throw off a lot more than just the lifetime table withdrawals. That's the whole idea of pooling your risk with millions of other retirees, if you will, through a single premium immediate annuity. It's supposed to pay out more money. It's called mortality credits. We've talked about that. So that's how it works. And don't let anyone who says, "Oh, I wouldn't want to do that. I'm going to have too much extra money." Oh, that's the whole point. You want the money to cover your minimum dignity floor.
Yeah. Which means even if you weren't getting it that way, you'd be taking it out, even though it's above your RMD. So you got to factor that in too. So, but yeah,
exactly.
It does change the RMD landscape for your situation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we answered this next one. When I originally saw it, when it came in, I thought, "Oh, I want to answer this right away." And I might have.
Stop
but
tapping
I usually,
on your table there.
Oh, sorry. Anyways, I usually mock them if I answer. If this rings a bell, just tell me and we'll move on. But do you remember when we did a series of shows? I don't know how they came. They weren't EDU shows, I don't think. And it came with we had a bunch of questions on the 5-year rules, and we're getting all these what ifs on this and that and the other thing. Mm-hmm. And you coined a term during that. You called it seasoned.
Seasoning, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what we were getting, well, let me read the question. If this rings a bell, we'll move on.
By the way, I had someone just in the last day or two refer to that, something similar as ripening.
Ripening, okay.
Yeah, that might be even better.
Okay. It says, hi, all. I love the show. I was just listening to the podcast, and this came in mid-November. And you mentioned that when rolling over a Roth 401k to a Roth IRA, that the funds were, quote-unquote, seasoned if they had been in the 401k for 5 years. This is not true. If you roll from a 401k to a Roth IRA without ever having had a Roth IRA before, then that will start a new 5-year clock that must be met. You may want to clarify this for your listeners. So I know I wanted to answer it. Does it ring a bell? I don't think I did.
I don't think we've answered that specific one. Yeah.
Okay. So let's follow a little bit of what's going on here that we're setting up. She is right and she's wrong. When you have, people should know to take money out of a Roth account, whether it's a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k, it must be qualified. And to take the earnings out, let me specify that.
I was going to say, be more specific there.
Yeah. Not just the contributions, which listeners should know, contributions can come out anytime, any reason, no taxes, no penalties. But to get the growth out, the distribution must be considered a qualified distribution. What qualifies? It's a two-prong test. First, the Roth IRA must be 5 years old. And in her example, she's saying if the Roth is brand new, it's not 5 years old. But first qualification, the Roth must be 5 years old. Second qualification, you must be over 59 and a half, dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home, at which point only $10,000 of earnings can come out tax-free. We're going to ignore the first-time home. We're going to ignore the disabled. We're going to ignore the dead. Those don't happen all the time, thankfully, and they're not germane to what the vast majority of people are going to experience. For most of you, qualification is going to be you have a Roth that's 5 years old and you're over 59 and a half. And that was the exact setup when we were talking on the podcast back in November. But what we were getting at was this. She's right. If you don't have an existing Roth IRA, and you move a Roth 401k into that Roth IRA, you still must wait 5 years to take out some of the growth.
Right.
I'm going to use that word some.
That's a good point, a good way of saying it, some. Mm-hmm.
So let's, perfect. I know you know the answer to this too, mm-hmm. So if you want to just chime in, you mm-hmm. can. So let's back up, Chris, to the 401k. In the example where you used the wording seasoning, mm-hmm. which I had not heard from, and now someone else is calling it ripened or ripening.
Yeah.
Ripened?
Yeah.
Ripened. Okay. Let's say you have a Roth 401k and you participated in it for many years, more than five. Mm-hmm. So could be 5, 6, 7, 10, doesn't matter. And let's just say, folks, to keep it round, you have $50,000 of contributions that were put in over that 5, mm-hmm. 8, 10-year period and a $150,000 Roth balance. $150,000 total, $50,000 of contributions, $100,000 of growth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you are over 59 and a half and the Roth 401k is more than 5 years, which was the mm-hmm. example we gave back in November, yep. Chris used the term seasoned.
Yep.
When you move that 401k to a Roth IRA, the seasoning isn't lost.
Right.
What Chris meant by seasoned was that money qualifies to come out tax-free. The $50,000 of contributions, which can always come out tax-free, and the $100,000 of growth, because it was qualified in the 401k. Chris termed it seasoned, because he knew once that $150,000 goes into a brand new, because you don't have a Roth IRA, a brand new IRA, all growth on that $150,000 is not qualified, because the Roth hasn't been open for 5 years.
Right.
But you don't lose the qualification on that $100,000 of growth. And you called it seasoned.
Right.
Anything else you want to add?
No, that you described it perfectly, in my opinion. The dollars that come over maintain their seasoning or their ripened nature. You don't lose that by moving it, even though it goes into a brandy new, to use your terminology, Roth IRA that doesn't have the 5 year age limit on it yet. But any subsequent growth from that point forward that happens while it's inside the brand new Roth IRA gets that 5 year restriction on it. So that's the distinction. It doesn't mean that all growth that's in there, which you lined it out perfectly, there's $100,000 of growth that comes over from the Roth 401k. As long as that growth had been seasoned or ripened while it was there, doesn't lose it when it moves over. That's the catch. That's the common misunderstanding. And I don't know if they understood it that way. And it was just kind of a two ways of interpreting the question. But this person who wrote this needs to be sure they're clear on what we just described.
Right. So she's semi-right. And the thing is, sadly, when I read consumer journals, I mean, I don't read Money Magazine and Kiplinger's or anything like that anymore. But if I'm in a doctor's waiting room or the dentist's office or just bored sometime and Yahoo links to one, they just say generally that if you move your 401k into a Roth IRA and you didn't have one that's 5 years old, the 5 year clock starts again.
Yeah, and they don't go into any deeper or detailed.
They don't get into it.
Yeah.
But you have to look at the qualification of that money in the Roth 401k. And it's the simple rule, folks, two-prong test. 5 years old, whether the 401k is 5 years old or the Roth IRA, each one has to be 5 years old, and you have to be over 59 and a half. If so, moving that 401k to the Roth IRA is, I like Chris's seasoning, but you can always use ripened. I think seasoned is better. But anyways, it's seasoned. It's there. And you can still specify and remove just that 150 at any time. Any growth has to wait 5 years. Okay.
Excellent.
Do we have time for more?
That's up to you. I know you've got a meeting, so if you can squeeze one more in, that's up to you. I can do it.
The person I'm meeting with texted me. No, she didn't get back a hold. Oh, nope, she confirmed. I can get a few more in. She's giving me
more
enough
time. Oh, well, let's
brief. Well, when I say a few more, we're going to have a...
I have time for one more. I don't have time for a few more.
We're going to have a new feature.
Oh, no.
You like how I hit you with these out of the blue.
We're going to do condensed format questions where it's like rapid fire. We have to answer them in a minute.
No, that wasn't what I was thinking, but we could try. That might be a fun one, too. Yeah, in a minute or less.
See if we could actually do it. Who can answer the question the best within 1 minute?
Nope. We're going to do PSAs. And not a PSA test for men. I'm over 50. We do that now. So
that's
PSA?
Top of mind. Yeah, that's top of mind now. Yeah.
Wait, at our age, when I hear PSA, I'm like, oh, I need another blood test. It's not that kind of PSA, folks. It's a public service announcement. We have been getting, and I just save them because they're not questions. And I'm like, oh, that's a good point. So I got so many of them, and we just got one in last week.
Okay.
I'm going to start, and we're going to just read them and say, these are just things that listeners want us to share with other listeners on the show.
Okay.
So if anybody, y'all are do-it-yourselfers. So if you got these little tidbits, little tips on retirement planning or gardening, I'll throw that out there. If you got any tips on gardening, especially growing shallots. I'm going to attempt to grow shallots and leeks this year. I haven't grown either of them ever in my life. Okay. So if you got any tips on them, please send them my way. but just the little tips that people have been given that they want me to share. So this one just came in this week, and I thought it was pretty good ones.
Okay.
He says, hey, I understand you are answering a specific question, but it might be a good follow-up to emphasize a few things on TOD accounts that you didn't mention. Remember we talked about transfer on death accounts last week?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. Was it last week? This came in on Saturday.
They come up periodically.
Oh, no, it would have been the week before because this came in on Saturday, which is already a week ago. Yeah. So 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So he just gives a couple of little bullet point, folks, on TOD accounts that he wanted everyone to know.
Mm-hmm.
He said they can keep the assets out of probate, thus keeping the county from taking their probate fees out of it. And he's true.
Good point. That is a good point.
TOD account skips probate, so the county can't assess any fees on it.
Mm-hmm.
It transfers to the recipient immediately. Mm-hmm. That is also true.
Yep.
Just like a beneficiary form on an IRA or an insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
The second the IRA owner is passed away, the second the doctor pronounces him dead or he's just done, that second that IRA is immediately owned as an inherited IRA. It's not technically owned by the beneficiaries immediately. Mm-hmm. There's no delay. There's no waiting to pass go. And the same thing with the TOD account, folks. And it allows the decedent, before they die, because you can't do it after, obviously, to specify a beneficiary that may otherwise be someone else who would not normally be an heir. So that is true as well. So if you have a will set up or something and you're passing everything off, but you like your neighbor, they helped you out, or in case my neighbor, he saved my life. If I want to help him out, I might leave an account to him as a TOD because it'll bypass my will, it bypass probate, and it just goes to the neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So he just kind of wanted to point that out. And then he goes on, he said, we learned all of this when my uncle, who was unmarried and never had children, kind of reminded me of myself, unmarried and never had children, died. He had several CDs, so that's a bank account. A TOD is how you move a non-IRA-style asset, or an asset that doesn't normally pass by, quote-unquote, right of law, which is a beneficiary form. He had several CDs of varying amount and was able to designate them directly to his nieces and nephews, family, and friends. And it passed immediately.
Mm-hmm. Nice and clean.
So just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect.
We have another little PSA, and then we'll probably wrap up. We'll only do two PSAs. I got like six of them, but we'll just do two today. Says, hello, Jim and Chris. And this came in, goodness, over a year ago.
Wow.
Really enjoy your show. I've learned so much as a do-it-yourselfer. The show is informative and fun and engaging. I usually listen to it as I do my cleaning chores.
Oh.
People seem to move and exercise.
I just talked to a walker this morning.
Mm-hmm. A walker?
Mm-hmm. He walks to our podcast.
Okay, so it's not a Walking Dead walker.
No.
It would be hard to understand.
Although they
could,
I guess, walk to our podcast. we specialize retirement planning for the undead. Go ahead.
Okay. That would be hard trying to do retirement
planning
for someone
who doesn't die. What the heck is an RMD for a zombie?
Well, it would also be hard to have a conversation with them because they'd just be going,
sure,
they can't talk, so it'd be really hard. Okay, now to my comment. In episode 2146, a questioner from Connecticut wanted to get a better sense of his Social Security payment in the future if he didn't have any more earned income. The Social Security Administration recently revamped their website, and I think you talked about this in the past, actually. And there is now a free plan for retirement estimator right there on the first page,
which allows
you to change variables such as your retirement age and future salary. Mm-hmm. But it has to be average future salary.
Right.
Results are presented both as a graph and a table. I find it very handy.
Mm-hmm. It's a definite improvement from before because the for people who weren't real close to 62, when you're close to 62, the old estimator actually did a pretty good job because the assumptions they were making didn't cause it to be off from your reality much, even if those assumptions didn't match you. Just the limited time involved caused the estimate to be pretty darn close. The farther you are from 62, the younger you are, the more your reality might be different than the assumptions they were making in those old basic estimates that they put on your, and even today that they put on your benefit estimate statement, even though they've changed and revamped that statement. One of those key assumptions is that you're going to continue to earn until the day you claim Social Security, you're going to earn what you made last year. That's their assumption. And if you didn't have earnings last year, they look back 2 years. But in any case, they're just picking a year and saying, let's just plug in and assume that's what you're going to earn until you turn 67 or 70 or whatever. If you're 55, that's, and you're planning to retire at 60, them assuming you're going to earn what you earned last year till 70 is really skewing your age 70 benefit, possibly. Depends on your earnings record. So that's what this tool does allow you to do. You can stick in your own average earnings. Now, the problem is you don't get to shut it off at the right time. That's still where it's weak, is you can override the average earning figure, but you can't say, no, I'm only going to plan till, I'm only going to work till 60, but I'm not going to claim till 70. So I'm going to have 10 years of zero in there. But between 55 and 60, I'm going to still have good earnings. I want you to assume that. The tool, to my knowledge, the last time I was on there, didn't allow you to model that kind of circumstance. So it's still not perfect, but it's better. I'll give them that. It is better because you can override a couple of things.
Perfect. Well, that's all I have. If okay. anybody has these PSAs, send them to me, but please put in the subject line PSA. Because then I'll know it's not really a question, and I'll put it in this. And whenever we have just a minute or two left, I'll just grab one and read it. They're not really questions, although Chris did expand a little on it, but just little tidbits that people want to share with our listeners.
Yeah. Sounds good. Well, you go have a nice meeting and a nice weekend after that. We want to thank everybody again for listening to another show. If you want to send in your own question or PSA, send it to Jim's email directly, jim@jimhelps.com. Label it as appropriate in the subject line, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.